All right, we are about to start our second study in the book of Jonah for the 2014 Bible Bee. This is going to be the first study in which we're actually looking at the text of the book. Last week, of course, we did an introduction to the entire book. For today, we're only going to be doing a small portion. As I mentioned before, we may not do exactly half of the chapter each time as we've done for the previous year Bible Bee studies. For today, we're only going to be looking at the first three verses of chapter 1. And then next time, of course, we'll cover quite a bit more of the material in chapter 1. So for today, let me read Jonah chapter 1, verses 1 through 3. And of course, these three verses really do serve as an introduction to the story and to the rest of the book. Jonah 1:1. Now the word of the Lord came to Jonah, the son of Amittai, saying, "Arise, go to Nineveh, that great city, and call out against it, for their evil has come up before me." But Jonah rose to flee to Tarshish from the presence of the Lord. He went down to Joppa and found a ship going to Tarshish. So he paid the fare and went on board to go with them to Tarshish, away from the presence of the Lord. Now the book of Jonah opens in a very similar way to the other books that we've identified in our introductory study last week as the books of the prophets. We talked about how the prophetic books of the Old Testament are toward the end of the Old Testament time period. Jonah, as a prophet, is called by the Lord to serve the Lord as a prophet, but he's called during the very beginning of that time period that all of the prophets prophesied in. It's toward the end of the Old Testament, but he's one of the first of the prophets that are sent by the Lord to deliver his message to the people that God wants to speak to. And we know that Jonah's a prophet from two different ways. One is right here in verse 1. Even though he's not called a prophet in verse 1, the way that he's introduced and the way that his mission is introduced identifies him for us as a prophet of the Lord, because we're told the word of the Lord came to Jonah. Now that's a phrase that's only used to describe how God would communicate to those that he marked out and laid his hand upon and called to the special assignment of being a prophet of God. Prophets of God in the Old Testament were men that the Lord set aside for a special purpose to be his messengers. They received specific messages from the Lord, and as the Lord spoke those specific messages to them, they were sent to deliver as messengers the word of the Lord from the Lord to the people that he was communicating to. Their assignment was to deliver exactly what the Lord said. They were to not add any words to the Lord's message, nor were they to take any words away from the Lord's message. Their job was simply to listen very carefully to what the Lord communicated to them, and then to pass that message on to whoever the Lord sent them to deliver that message. Now, he's identified here as also the son of Amittai. We spoke a little bit about who Amittai was last time in our introductory study, and we'll turn back to that passage. You can keep your place in Jonah chapter 1. And let's look back again as Jonah is introduced in one other book of the Bible, in the book of 2 Kings chapter 14. 2 Kings chapter 14, where Amittai is also mentioned there, as well as Jonah. 2 Kings 14, we're reading just a single verse, verse 25. This is speaking about Amaziah and the king, who is the king of Israel. And it says in verse 25, "He restored the border of Israel from Lebo Hamath as far as the Sea of the Arabah, according to the word of the Lord, the God of Israel, which he spoke by his servant Jonah, the son of Amittai, the prophet, who was from Gath-Hepher." Now we saw in our study last time, our introduction, that Gath-Hepher was in the northern part of Israel. So Jonah is part of the northern kingdom. Remember, the kingdom has been separated into two sections. There's a northern kingdom, which is 10 tribes. There's a southern kingdom, which is 2 tribes. Jerusalem and Judah are in that southern kingdom. But Jonah is part of that northern alliance of 10 tribes. This is after the time of David, after the time of Solomon, where the Lord has separated the kingdom. And so he's in the region that we call Galilee. And he is the son of a man who himself was a prophet. This man's name was Amittai. And Jonah is introduced here himself as one who served the Lord. So we see he's identified as his servant, that's the Lord's servant, Jonah, the son of Amittai, the prophet who was from Gath-Hepher. So we know that not only was Jonah a prophet of God, but his father was a prophet of God. Now, a couple of interesting details that are part of this introduction that are not, we don't want to read too much significance into these, but the details are important to notice. And that is Jonah's name and Jonah's description here in this passage. And of course, Jonah's name is the same for the book of Jonah and as he's introduced in the book of Jonah as it is here in 2 Kings. The name Jonah is the Hebrew word for dove. So as people referred to Jonah, as they knew Jonah, it would be as if in our language I was introduced to you and you were introduced to me as, this is Dove. His name was literally Dove, which is the bird that we're all familiar with. Now, why is that significant at all? Well, anytime you see a name that's unusual in that way, and Jonah was an unusual name for a man to have, typically when we name young boys and they're going to grow into young men, we would typically choose a more manly kind of name than to name our sons Dove, because dove is a kind of a bird that is not like an eagle. It's not like a falcon or a hawk. It's not a big hunting bird. A dove is actually, as we know it, even down to our culture and our society, our time, it's known as a bird symbolizing peace. It symbolizes rest. It symbolizes something quite a bit different than a warlike or dominant kind of characteristic. But the dove plays a very important role symbolically in the Bible. And it serves a special communication purpose or symbol from the Lord to his people. Do you remember the very first time in the Bible that the dove is mentioned? Yes.
When Noah lets her out of the ark.
Absolutely. It's from the story of the flood, and it's from the time of Noah. In fact, let's turn back and remind ourselves of the very first time a dove is mentioned. Genesis chapter 8. This is, of course, after the flood has already taken place, and the ark is on the sea, and Noah and his family are safe within the confines of the ark, and the rains have now stopped, and Noah is trying to determine whether the waters have sufficiently receded so that it would soon be safe to disembark from the ark. And in the story we're reading from Genesis chapter 8, verses 8 through 11. This is Noah's actions after he first opened a window of the ark and sent a raven out to test the waters. And the raven never returned to the ark. And then in verse 8, he sent forth a dove from him to see if the waters had subsided from the face of the ground. Now I want you to understand, in the original Hebrew text, this is how it reads in verse 8. Then he sent forth a Jonah from him. This is Jonah's name. And then it goes on to say, but the dove found no place to set her foot, and she returned to him on the ark, to the ark, for the waters were still on the face of the whole earth. So he put out his hand and took her and brought her into the ark with him. He waited another 7 days, and again he sent forth the dove out of the ark. And the dove came back to him in the evening, and behold, in her mouth was a freshly plucked olive leaf. So Noah knew that the waters had subsided from the earth. Then he waited another 7 days and sent forth the dove, and she did not return to him anymore. And it was soon after that that the story unfolds with them disembarking from the ark. So the dove plays a very important role symbolically in God's story. And we know the story of the flood and the story of the ark is ultimately a story of God's judgment upon the sinful people on the earth. But it's not just a story of judgment. The flood is not only a story of judgment, it's also a story of God's faithfulness and his purpose to restore and rebuild the world and the human population of the world in order to accomplish his great purpose through judgment. And so it's possibly what we call a coincidence that the prophet that God assigned to take his message to the Gentile nation of Assyria and to the people of Nineveh happened to be called Dove, which connects to the main themes both of the flood of Noah and the time of Jonah and the circumstance of what God was doing with the people of Nineveh. But I don't believe that there are any coincidences of that nature in the Bible. This is a subtle description from the Lord, a message from the Lord of how he is about to deal with the people who deserve his judgment, but he's going to display his faithfulness, his goodness, and his kindness in this circumstance. And I believe he hints at that by choosing out of all of the people in Israel that he could have called to send to Nineveh, he chose one who bore the name Dove. All right, so we have that hint right from the very beginning as the book is introduced, that the Lord chose a man who symbolized something in God's purpose and heart and intentions toward the people of Nineveh. Now the second thing, and we'll have to turn back again to 2 Kings 14. We were there just a minute ago. 2 Kings 14, verse 25, as we read before, is the brief description that's attached to Jonah's name. And it's important for us to read this description because Jonah, through the generations of Christians reading the story of the book of Jonah, has gotten somewhat of a bad reputation. We all know the story of Jonah. We know that God sent him to Nineveh. He didn't want to go to Nineveh, and he ran. He went the opposite direction. And we know the whole story of him being swallowed by the great fish and how the book unfolds. But our first impression of Jonah in the book of Jonah is that this is a man who was resisting and rebelling against God's call and purpose for his life. But that's not the overall picture that we're meant to have of this man, Jonah. And so in 14:25, he's introduced in a detail given to us that is not given to us in the book of Jonah. We read this it's implied in Jonah, but it's not mentioned like it is here. So in 2 Kings 14:25, we read this. He restored the border of Israel, that's not Jonah, but the king, from Lebo Hamath as far as the Sea of the Arabah, according to the word of the Lord, the God of Israel, which he spoke by whom? Spoke by his servant Jonah, the son of Amittai, the prophet who was from Gath-Hepher. So Jonah is introduced by a brief description, and this is the Lord's description of who Jonah actually was. He's described by the Lord as his servant Jonah. And the word for servant that's used here from the original text refers to what is the same concept that Paul the Apostle later uses more than once in the New Testament to describe his own calling, to describe his own relationship with the Lord. When Paul refers to himself as a bond slave of Christ. Now, a bond slave or the word that Jonah uses here, bondservant, literally in the original text, referred to someone who belonged entirely as a slave to someone else. They were not their own. They did not belong to themselves. They were not in charge of their own life, but they were wholly given over to the service of a master who, in a sense, owned their life, was completely in charge of their life. So Jonah was, prior to the events of the book of Jonah, and prior to Jonah chapter 1, verse 1, Jonah was a true servant of the Lord. And he had faithfully served the Lord as a prophet of God, delivering the message of God to the people that God had previously sent him to deliver that message to. Now, in the book of Jonah, we know that the Lord gives him an assignment to go to Nineveh, which is a Gentile nation, and to deliver the word of the Lord to the Gentiles. But before the Lord ever sent him to the Gentiles, the Lord had called him to be a servant and a prophet and sent him to his own people, Israel. And he was sent to deliver a message to his own people, Israel. What was that message? We see it in verse 25 again. I'll read it one last time. He restored, the king did, the border of Israel from one location to the other location, according to the word of the Lord, the God of Israel, which he spoke by his servant Jonah. God had sent Jonah to Israel prior to the events of the book of Jonah, and he had sent him with a completely different kind of message that he was sent to Nineveh to deliver. The message that God sent Jonah to Nineveh to deliver was a message of God's impending, soon to take place, judgment upon the city. But the message that God had given Jonah to deliver to the people of Israel prior to the assignment to Nineveh was a completely different kind of message. It's what we would call a very positive message. It was a message of great blessing. It was a message that Israel has lost some of its territory in times past, and they had. They had, through their own foolishness and their own rebellion against the Lord, they had lost territory to other nations that were encroaching on their borders. And now the Lord sent Jonah the prophet, his servant, to Israel, and he predicted by the word of the Lord that the Lord would bless Israel by restoring the fullness of their borders from this location to this other location that are mentioned here in verse 25. That was a very welcomed message by Israel. That's a message that's easy for any prophet to deliver. It would be like saying, if I was a prophet to the United States of America, it would be like saying, the Lord has spoken to me to tell America that you're going to be blessed and the country's only going to get richer. The country is going to get greater. We're going to take over more and more territory. The Lord is going to bless this land. Do you think people listening in the country would like that message or dislike that message? Well, everybody likes to receive a message like that. You're going to be more prosperous. You're going to take over more territory. You know, good times are ahead of the nation in the near future. That was the message Jonah had previously been given by the Lord to deliver. So he was what we would call, prior to the start of the book of Jonah, a positive prophet. He had been given a positive message, a welcomed message, a message that the people enjoyed listening to. Now that's about to change for Jonah, because now he is going to be sent to a different people, and he's going to be given a different kind of message to deliver. A message that's not going to be so welcomed by the people that are going to hear it and to receive it, at least as far as Jonah can determine at this point. All right, so that's our introduction to Jonah. Now let's go back to the book of Jonah and see the details of the assignment that the Lord gives to him. Verse 2. This is now the Lord speaking. He's speaking directly to Jonah. Arise, go to Nineveh, that great city, and call out against it, for their evil has come up before me. All right, the Lord gives a three-part assignment to Jonah. There's three elements, or three aspects, to what the Lord assigns to Jonah. The first one seems pretty obvious and pretty simple. So why did the Lord even say the first part? What's the first part of his assignment?
Arise.
Well, of course, if we don't know if Jonah was sitting down when the Lord spoke this to him, or it's possible he was lying down on his bed. We don't know what his actual circumstance and posture was at the very moment the Lord spoke to him. But we do know that he wasn't standing up at the moment that the Lord spoke this to him, because the Lord essentially told him the word arise means literally stand up. So why would the Lord have to say this to him? Why wouldn't he just jump over part one? And why wouldn't he say part two and part three? Because in order to do part two, he would have to stand up in order to get to Nineveh. Why would he even say the first part? Well, this is part of God's graciousness to us. And it's his graciousness to Jonah. The only reason he would even say the first part is it's helping Jonah's heart get in the mode of you're now under the Lord's assignment. It's like saying, it's like if you were about to go to church and your parents said to you, okay, brush your teeth, get your clothes on, and get ready. Well, of course, if you're going to go to church, you already know I need to brush my teeth, I need to get my clothes on, and I need to get ready. So why would your parents even say that to you? It's them being gracious to you to get your heart in the mode of, okay, I'm under assignment right now. It's time to get serious about the next step of what's going to take place in my life. So I see this as God's graciousness to Jonah. He's getting him ready. He's getting him in ready mode. Because prior to this word, Jonah's heart was not in ready mode. And we see from how Jonah responds that his heart never quite got into ready mode. But the Lord spoke this to him because he knew his heart needed to kind of ramp up and get ready to obey the Lord. Sometimes our hearts, by God's grace, are in a place where I'm ready. Whatever you say, Lord, whatever you have assigned for me next, I'm ready for this. But most often, when the Lord has an assignment for us, we're not yet quite ready to tackle that assignment. And so we can anticipate the Lord giving us some advance notice to start getting that shift going in our attitude and in our perspective to get ready to obey the Lord with whatever it is that he is requiring of us next. So the Lord says to him, arise. And then he gives him what had to be for Jonah an unexpected assignment. Go to Nineveh. Now, I mentioned this in our introduction last week, but it's worth repeating again. This makes Jonah's assignment unusual among all the prophets, among all the prophetic books, starting from Isaiah and going all the way through Malachi, the four major prophets and the 12 minor prophets. All of them were sent either to the northern tribes of the people of Israel or to the southern tribes of the people of Judah in the south. None of them were sent on a far distant missionary-like assignment to another nation where they would have to travel outside the borders of either Israel or Judah. Nineveh was northeast of where Galilee was located, where Jonah lived, and he would, in order to get from where he was to where the Lord's assignment was, he would have to travel approximately 600 miles. Now, that's more than the distance from where we are today, this morning here in the Los Angeles area, is it would be further than if we were to travel to the city of San Francisco in the north. Now, if I was going to be sent by the Lord to San Francisco to deliver the Lord's message to the city of San Francisco, how do you think I would go from here to there? I have to have different options. I could get in my car, which is parked out front, and I could drive there in a few hours' time. I could drive down to the local airport, either Burbank Airport, I could go to Los Angeles Airport, and I could get on a plane and I could be there in under 2 hours. I could take a bus. I could get on a motorcycle, though I don't ride motorcycles. I could go that route. And you know what? Worst case scenario, let's just say none of those were available to me. I could get on a bicycle like Mr. Spadrari, who rides a bicycle every day, and I could bike up to San Francisco. It would take time. It would take effort. But I'd get there much faster on a bicycle than how Jonah would need to travel. How would Jonah get from Galilee to Nineveh, 600 miles, and it wasn't all nice and green and, you know, super highway between Galilee and Nineveh. How would he get from one location to another traveling 600 miles? He would either have to take a horse, a chariot, if he was particularly rich, and if there was a highway between one location and the other. He could ride on a cart. He could, of course, walk. Well, one way or the other, that's slow going for 600 miles. And this was, for Jonah, among all the prophets, a very interesting and a very unusual assignment. But it's interesting in the telling of the account here, and we see this in these first three verses, Jonah never argues with the Lord about the Lord's assignment. Now, in his heart, he resists the Lord's assignment. And with his actions, of course, he rebels against the Lord's assignment. But there's no argument between Jonah and the Lord. It's not like when the Lord first called Moses to be his servant and his messenger, and the Lord sent Moses to Egypt under assignment. And we read that Moses began to argue with the Lord and to try to convince the Lord that the Lord was making a mistake in calling him to be the prophet to send to the people of God that were in slavery in Egypt. And of course, Moses trying to argue didn't really excuse him from his assignment any more than Jonah was excused from his assignment. But Jonah doesn't argue with the Lord, as unusual as this assignment is. And yet, in his heart, he does resist and ultimately rebel against it. Now, what can we know, though, about the Lord's assignment in sending him to Nineveh? I mentioned this in our previous study, and I'll rehearse it again today. One of the principles that was revealed right here in verse 2 that kind of carries through the story of the remainder of the book and will be in the backdrop of all of our studies in Jonah from this point forward. The Lord sends him to Nineveh. The Ninevites did not know that Yahweh, the God of Israel, the Lord of Israel, was Lord over Nineveh. The Ninevites were religious people. They had, though, their own religion. They worshipped their own gods, and the gods that they worshipped were not the God of Israel. And in their minds, they prayed to the gods that they worshipped because they believed that the gods that they worshipped had made them a great and a powerful nation and had blessed them with victory over many other nations. We're going to be talking a little bit more about that in a moment. But this verse, when the Lord says to Jonah, "Arise and go to Nineveh," gives us a hint about the Lord's relationship with Nineveh. The Ninevites had no relationship with the Lord. They worshipped other gods. But the Lord had a relationship with the Ninevites. This is an important principle. The Ninevites had no relationship with the Lord. They were in spiritual darkness and they were in spiritual ignorance. and they were in spiritual rebellion against the Lord. But they were ignorant. They did not know who God really was. They did not know the true Lord. They did not know the scriptures. They did not understand. But God knew them. The Lord was Lord over them in spite of the fact that they didn't acknowledge Him. They didn't worship Him. And they didn't obey Him. But that doesn't mean just because they ignored the Lord that the Lord was ignoring them. So right now, on the face of planet Earth, there is over 6 billion people alive. Just right now, today, over 6 billion people alive. Out of that 6 billion, how many people acknowledge that the God of the Bible is actually God? Now, I'm not even talking about how many are born again, how many know the Lord in a true way, the way the Bible describes. I'm just saying, how many of those 6 billion acknowledge that the God of the Bible is God? The largest estimate number is 1 billion recognize the God of the Bible as the one true and living God. That means that there's 5 billion people on the face of planet Earth today that are in the same kind of spiritual ignorance and darkness and rebellion that the Ninevites were in Jonah's day. And they are ignoring the Lord. But the Lord is not ignoring them. And the fact that they're in rebellion against the Lord's authority does not mean that the Lord does not actually have authority over their lives. And so the Lord, in His not ignoring the Ninevites, in His paying attention to what's going on in Nineveh, now raises up a prophet, gives him a special and unusual assignment, and sends him 600 miles across country, going to the north and to the east to travel to the great city of Nineveh to deliver a single message from the Lord. And what is the nature of that message? This is the next part of the Lord's assignment. The first part, arise. Second part, go to Nineveh. The third part, call out against it. This is the third element or the third part of Jonah's assignment from the Lord. Call out against the city of Nineveh. Now, what is interesting at this point in the story, as the Lord first gives an assignment to Jonah, is that the Lord does not give him the details of what his message is going to be. He doesn't give him the specific words that he's going to speak. That is going to take place later in the book. And let's just jump ahead in our study for a moment to chapter 3. And we'll see the portion at which Jonah receives the specific assignment of the particular message that he's going to deliver to the city of Nineveh. So turn with me to Jonah chapter 3, verse 1. And of course, eventually in our study, we'll come to this and we'll look at it in greater detail at that point. It says, then the word of the Lord came to Jonah the second time, saying, arise, same word from chapter 1 when he spoke to him to arise, go to Nineveh, same assignment as before, that great city, and call out against it, what? The message that I tell you. At this point, the Lord is reminding him he's being sent to deliver a message. But even at this point in the story, Jonah still doesn't know exactly what he's supposed to say once he gets there to the city. He is aware of what kind of message it's going to be. The kind of message is described by the words, call out against it. That simply means it's going to be a message of the Lord's coming judgment. And that judgment is going to occur soon. Not 1,000 years in Nineveh's future, but sometime soon in the near future to Nineveh, the Lord is going to bring judgment upon the city. And at this point, though, Jonah doesn't know exactly what he's going to say. But let's read on. Verse 3, so Jonah arose and went to Nineveh according to the word of the Lord. Now Nineveh was an exceedingly great city, 3 days' journey in breadth. Jonah began to go into the city, going a day's journey, and he called out. And by the time he gets there, we're not told exactly between the time the Lord spoke to him the assignment and the time that he arrives exactly when he knew what message to say. But somewhere in between these two moments, Jonah now knows clearly the exact message he's to deliver. And the message is, yet 40 days and Nineveh shall be overthrown. So we know from the message he eventually does proclaim, it is very specifically a message of judgment. And it's a message of judgment from the Lord. And it's a message of soon occurring judgment. How long would the delay be between, and we talked about this last time, but how long would be the delay between the proclamation of the Lord's message through Jonah and the actual judgment that would fall on the city? A 40-day delay. Can you imagine? Can you imagine if God sent a prophet to the city of Los Angeles and the message, as he stood in the midst of the city and proclaimed, as he's walking from one end of the city to the other, in 40 more days, Los Angeles will be no more. That's a dramatic and powerful and fearful message that was given to Jonah. But at this point in the story, back in chapter 1, he doesn't know the details. He simply knows that his assignment is to get up, get his heart ready to serve the Lord. That's arise. Two, to make the journey to Nineveh, 600 miles. If you were to walk, let's just say he walked because that's the most likely way he would journey. How long would it take to get from Galilee to Nineveh? If you were in good shape and if you had good endurance, you could probably walk about 20 miles a day. And at the end of the day, you're going to need to stop. You're going to need to rest, get some sleep, get some food, and then get ready to get up in the morning and walk another 20 miles, right? So how long is it going to take him? It would take him 5 days to walk approximately 100 miles. And it would take him 6 repetitions of that 5-day journey, which is approximately a 1-month journey if you were walking every day for 30 days, and you were walking a full 20 miles. Anybody here ever walked 20 miles in one day? That's not an easy walk, is it? 20 miles is not an easy walk. It's almost the length of an entire marathon. All right? So you were to do 20 miles, and you were to do that over and over and over again for an entire month. He could arrive in the city of Nineveh in about 1 month time. It gives him lots of time on the road. It's not like he has anything else to do while he's walking. It gives him lots of time to consider what's going to happen once he gets there, and to think about what's going on and what the Lord is about to do and what the Lord's assignment is. So he's told to arise, get his heart ready to serve the Lord. He's told to take this long, 1 month long journey to the city of Nineveh. And he's told in advance by the Lord what kind of message he's going to deliver. Not the details, just the kind of message. A message of God's coming judgment upon the city. Now, one other detail in verse 2 before we go on to verse 3. And that is what the Lord says at the end of verse 2, which is very important for us to understand. First, arise, go to Nineveh, that great city, and call out against it. And then this little word, for. F-O-R. For. Their evil has come up before me. The word for introduces the rest of the verse and describes it to us as what we call a purpose clause. It's a purpose clause. What the Lord is saying after the word for is describing the purpose in the Lord's heart in sending Jonah on his assignment. We can also describe it this way. It's the Lord's explanation of why he's sending Jonah to the city of Nineveh. Now, this by itself is an amazing thing. When the Lord calls a prophet to be his messenger, and we have many examples of that in the Bible. I mentioned Moses earlier, the first great prophet of Israel, but there were many other prophets that God sent to his people. And when he does call a man to be a prophet, to be his messenger, to deliver his message, he does not always give to the prophet an explanation of why he's been called and given the message that he's been given. Why? Because the Lord does not owe the prophet who is the messenger, the servant of the Lord, nor does he owe the people that are receiving the message. The Lord does not owe any explanation to the people that he's speaking to. Why doesn't he owe them an explanation? Think about it this. The message that Jonah's about to deliver is, in 40 more days, your entire life is coming to an end. The whole nation in which you live, the city in which you live, is going to be coming to a crashing end. You'd think the Lord would owe them some explanation. And if you were the messenger sent to deliver such a life-changing, life-shattering message, you would think that the messenger would be owed an explanation. But the Lord doesn't owe anybody any explanations about what he does because he is the Lord. He made them. They only have life and breath by his gracious and powerful influence upon their lives. He gave them life, and it's within his right to take away their life if it serves his purpose to do so. This is a hint about the word that I use as a core principle running through the entire book of Jonah in our introduction last week. This is a hint of the sovereignty of God. But what's interesting here is that while the Lord doesn't owe any explanation, in this case, he gives one. In this case, he doesn't give an explanation to Nineveh, but he does give an explanation to his messenger, his servant, Jonah. Why would he give an explanation to Jonah in this circumstance? I think it's God's mercy and grace for Jonah, because the Lord knows what an unusual assignment this is. As I mentioned already, this is the only prophet sent 600 miles away to deliver a message to an entirely different people than the people of God. It was so unusual that I believe the Lord was gracious to say to Jonah, let me give you an explanation of why I'm sending you on this assignment. And when the Lord, who doesn't owe an explanation, is gracious and merciful to give one to his people, that explanation should satisfy the one that he's giving it to. Unfortunately, Jonah's not satisfied by the Lord's explanation. He hears it. He understands the explanation, but he's not satisfied by it. He doesn't like what the Lord is doing in giving him this assignment, and he doesn't like the Lord's explanation in why he was doing it. So what's the Lord's explanation for Jonah to understand? The explanation is, for their evil, he's speaking of the people of Nineveh, their evil has come up before me. Now, I'm going to give you a theological term. It's a big word. It's a somewhat complex concept, but it's an important concept for you to understand. This is a word that theologians use to describe some of the descriptions of the Lord that we find in some of the more mysterious portions in the Bible. It's the term anthropomorphism. You can check with me later for spelling if you want to make sure to get the spelling right. Anthropomorphism. This simply means that there are times in the Bible where the Lord is described as though he were like us, even though he's always greater than us, more powerful than us, more knowledgeable than us, more wise than us. But there are times in the telling of the story of the Bible, the Lord is described as though he was like one of us, so that we can relate and identify and understand something of why the Lord is doing what he's doing. In this case, the anthropomorphism is the idea that prior to this moment, the Lord didn't fully understand what was going on in Nineveh. Meaning, the reason he is motivated to send Jonah on this assignment is their evil has come up before me. It's very similar to the story in the life of Abraham when the Lord and Abraham stood on a hillside, kind of a cliff looking out over a particular valley where the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah were. And the Lord had sent two angels to the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, and he told Abraham he sent those angels in order to do what? To find out, to determine how wicked those cities were. It's presented as if the Lord didn't already know exactly how wicked those cities were. But the Lord did know. And in this circumstance, the Lord knew about the evil of the Ninevites before it came up before him. Coming up before him is just describing that the account of their wickedness has risen all the way to heaven, all the way to the throne of God in heaven. And what it's really describing is that the Ninevites had become so wicked that the reputation of their wickedness had risen all the way up to heaven itself. But don't misunderstand and think that that means that God didn't know about their wickedness before it rose to that level. All right, so what the Lord is saying to Jonah is, my explanation of why I'm sending you is that there is evil in the world that I'm about to deal with. Now, he doesn't give that last part of what I'm saying is in the heart of the Lord. But that's the implication of sending the prophet with a word of judgment that's coming upon the city. Is their evil has reached such a level that now the Lord is going to act. The idea is this, and this runs throughout the Bible. There's always evil in the world. Always. Because there's always sin in the world. And evil, because of sin, always deserves God's judgment and God's punishment. But God is also gracious and he is merciful and he gives human beings a certain amount of time and a certain amount of space in order for their sins to reach a certain level before he responds and acts in judgment. And that's what had gone on with the Ninevites. Their sin level had reached the top of the vessel that the Lord had appointed for them. And now it was time to act. Now it was time to put an end to their wickedness. And so he was sending Jonah to deliver his message. Now, verse 3, this is where the most famous part of the story starts. And we won't get as far, of course, as Jonah being on the ocean, and we won't get as far as the fish that's going to eventually swallow him, as we know the famous story. But let's read verse 3 again as the story unfolds from here. It says, "But Jonah rose to flee to Tarshish from the presence of the Lord. He went down to Joppa and found a ship going to Tarshish. So he paid the fare and went on board to go with them to Tarshish away from the presence of the Lord." Now, first thing I want you to notice is in verse 3, Jonah obeys the first part of the Lord's assignment. Remember, there were three parts of the Lord's special assignment to Jonah. Part number 3 had to do with crying out against the city of Nineveh. Part 2 was you got to make the journey from Galilee overland to Nineveh. But what was part 1 of the assignment? Arise. So what did Jonah do in verse 3? He arose. So far, so good. He's obeying God, right? Wrong. His actions at this moment are obedient, but his heart is not obedient. So he's rising, but he's rising with the wrong plan in his heart, the wrong decision in his heart, the wrong intention in his heart. God is more concerned. He is concerned about our actions. He's very concerned about our actions. He pays attention to every single one of them. But he's even more concerned with our hearts and our intentions, our motives, the reasons why we do what we do in response to his requirements upon our lives. So Jonah rose And he rose with this intention in his heart to flee from the presence of the Lord. And we'll talk more about that in a moment, but let's get some of the practical stuff out of the way. He rose to flee to Tarshish, and he first went down to Joppa. Now, Joppa was south of Galilee. It's almost due west of the city of Jerusalem, but that was far south of where he was located in northern Galilee. It was a seaport. It was famous as a seaport. It's the very seaport that earlier in the story, when Solomon built the temple, he brought a lot of the materials to Jerusalem by bringing them by ship to the seaport of Joppa, and then they were transported overland from Joppa to the city of Jerusalem. But it was a Gentile seaport. It was not controlled at this point in time. It was not controlled at this point in time by the Israelites. So it was a Gentile seaport that was used for Gentile commerce, travel by ship, and a lot of business being done by ship. Now Tarshish, very interesting circumstance here with Tarshish. There's two or three different possibilities of where Tarshish was, but the best archaeological evidence tells us this was a well-known seaport as far west from Israel and from the promised land, from the location of Joppa and where Jonah was located, as modern-day Spain. It was a seaport in Spain, which is the far end of the Mediterranean Sea. So Joppa is on the eastern coast of the Mediterranean Sea, leading into the promised land. Spain, and the city in those days, because Spain didn't exist in those days as a nation, just as a geographic location, but it wasn't called Spain then. Tarshish was a Phoenician seaport. The Phoenicians were famous shipbuilders, and they did great merchandising using their ships sailing from one location to another. So with Jonah's intention to go to Tarshish, he was planning to go to the farthest known seaport west of the Promised Land. Beyond Tarshish, no one had ever traveled, as far as they knew. So it was like going, if my assignment from the Lord was to go preach to people in Alaska, in the far, far, far north, it would be like, okay, if I'm Jonah, I'm going to want to go to the very tip of South America in the far south. I'm going to go down to Argentina, and I'm going to go down to the very southern tip of Argentina. He was intending to travel the opposite direction from the city of Nineveh and to go as far in the opposite direction as it was possible to travel by boat and by sea, of course. Now, what is mentioned here twice in this section is that he was fleeing from the presence of the Lord. At the beginning of verse 3, Jonah rose to flee to Tarshish from the presence of the Lord. And at the end of verse 3, he did go down to Tarshish. He went down to Joppa to pay the fare to go on a boat to Tarshish, away from the presence of the Lord. Now, we're going to talk in just a moment about this concept of the presence of the Lord. But I want to ask first the question, why did Jonah not want to go to Nineveh? Why did he want to go the opposite direction? Why would a man who was known as a prophet of God and who had faithfully served the Lord as a prophet of God in his previous assignment from the Lord to deliver a positive message to the people of Israel, why would Jonah suddenly turn spiritual traitor? Why would he desert his assignment? Why would he try to run away from his assignment? It's because of the challenge and the difficulty of this particular assignment. It's not that Jonah suddenly went from loving the Lord to hating the Lord. I believe that Jonah still loved the Lord in his heart. And I believe Jonah still wanted to serve the Lord. He just didn't want to serve the Lord in this assignment. This particular mission that God was sending him on was a mission that he wanted no part of. And the reason why, we have a hint of it in 2 Kings. Let's turn back there again. 2 Kings, now chapter 19. It has something to do with the nation of Assyria and its capital city, Nineveh, and the reputation of that nation at this time in history. 2 Kings chapter 19. This is kind of the backstory of the reputation of Nineveh and the Assyrians. 2 Kings 19, I'm going to read verses 15 through 19. Now, this isn't from Jonah's story, but this is from the story of a king of Israel known as Hezekiah. We're going to read from verse 15. And Hezekiah prayed before the Lord and said, O Lord, the God of Israel, enthroned above the cherubim, you are the God, you alone, of all the kingdoms of the earth. You have made heaven and earth. Incline your ears, O Lord. Hear and open your eyes, O Lord, and see. And hear the words of Sennacherib. Now, Sennacherib was at a different time in history, but it's near the time of Jonah. Sennacherib was the king of Assyria, the king of Nineveh. Hear the words of Sennacherib, which he has sent to mock the living God. Truly, O Lord, the kings of Assyria, that means not just at one moment in history, but during this entire time period, this is what was going on and this is what Jonah knew. The kings of Assyria have laid waste the nations and their lands and have cast their gods into the fire, for they were not gods, but the work of men's hands, wood and stone. Therefore they were destroyed. So now, O Lord our God, save us, please, from his hand, that all the kingdoms of the earth may know that you, O Lord, are God alone. Now, the reputation of the Assyrians is identified for us in verse 17. Truly, O Lord, the kings of Assyria, that's Nineveh, have laid waste the nations and their lands. The Assyrians were conquerors, much like the Babylonians, who came along later and actually conquered the Assyrians, much like the Medes and the Persians, who came along and conquered the Babylonians, much like the Greeks, who came along and conquered the Persians, and much like the Romans, who came along later in history and conquered the Greeks. They were a conquering nation. But when they went out to conquer other nations around them, they didn't walk up to the capital cities of these other nations, knock on the door politely and say, can we please come in and take charge of your nation? They went to war, and they were known, their reputation were they were very aggressive and very brutal in the way they imposed their will on the other nations. And they ruled by what we call intimidation, meaning they would be so brutal after they conquered one nation that all the other nations would just give up and not fight against them in the future. I'm going to give you a brief description. This is going to be somewhat challenging, especially for the younger children, but I think this is important for you to understand because this is something that Jonah knew about. And there's a reason why, there's a strong reason why in his heart he did not want to go to the city of Nineveh. He didn't want anything to do with the Assyrians. This is from history and this is from archaeology. This is not just people guessing. We know what the Assyrians were like and the kinds of things they did. After they would conquer one nation, and as they were marching with their armies outside the boundaries of the next capital city they were about to conquer, they would do things like this. They would take all of the bones of the soldiers that they had conquered in battle and defeated and killed in battle, and they would build a pyramid of their bones out in front of the capital city. And then they would take the skin of those soldiers and drape them like the covering of the pyramid. And the people inside the city that they were about to conquer would watch them building this pyramid right outside of their city gates. And it was a message to say, if you resist us, this is what's going to happen to you. Now, that's just one example. I could give you a dozen examples of even more terrible things that they did than what I just described. But I just chose the lightest of the terrible things that they did so that it wouldn't shock you too much to understand what the Ninevites were really like. They were horrible, horrible people. They were exceptionally wicked. They were exceptionally brutal and evil in the way that they conducted their military business. We talk in our armed forces today about having what are called rules of engagement. That means even when we send our armies off to battle, we give them rules so that they're not too mean in the way that they conquer who they're fighting against. But the Assyrians had no such rules that they paid attention to. They would do anything necessary in order to intimidate their next victims and to send the message that there is no point in resisting us because this is how strong and how powerful and how mean we are. We will go to any extreme in order to conquer you. Jonah knew this. He understood this about the Ninevites. It was well known by everybody that this was the kind of people that the Assyrians were. And so Jonah wanted nothing to do with them. He didn't want to travel to their city. He didn't want to deliver them any message. Because the question is, if Jonah didn't like the Assyrians, and he did not like the Assyrians, he did not like the people of Nineveh, why wouldn't he want to go and deliver this message from the Lord? Because remember, it was a message of judgment upon them, upon the Ninevites. You would think if Jonah didn't like them, he would want to go and to deliver the message of the Lord's judgment. But the backstory, and one that we'll focus on more when we eventually get there, let's go back to Jonah and let's look ahead for just a moment in the story. Jonah chapter 4. And we'll read verse 2. This is Jonah's word to the Lord in prayer toward the end of the story. And he prayed to the Lord and said, O Lord, is not this what I said when I was yet in my country? His country was Galilee. His country was northern Israel. So Jonah spoke to the Lord when he first received the Lord's assignment. We're not told about that in chapter 1, but we learn about it now in chapter 4. So Jonah received this assignment from the Lord, and when he received this assignment, he spoke back to the Lord. And essentially said to him, I don't want to go on this assignment because I know what you're going to do. You're sending me to pronounce judgment, but this is what you'll end up doing. That, he said, is this not what I said when I was yet in my country? That is why I made haste to flee to Tarshish. So if you ask the question, why did Jonah flee? This is why he fled. This is his own heart's explanation. For I knew that you are a gracious God and merciful, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and relenting from disaster. He knew that the Lord was sending him with a message of judgment against Nineveh, but he also knew that by the Lord sending him with the message of judgment, that the Lord's real purpose was to show mercy and grace if the people responded in the right way to that message of judgment and repented. Because if the Lord had only planned the destruction of the city of Nineveh, he would never have sent a prophet with a message of coming judgment to begin with. You know, when we hear the words of the Lord of coming judgment, and in those portions of the Bible where he describes judgment as coming, for instance, the famous book of Revelation is a description of the Lord's coming judgment. Whenever we read a message from the Lord of a coming judgment, it always contains within it an opportunity for us to turn. Because if the Lord speaks the message and he gives us the time to hear the message, he's giving us the opportunity to respond to the message and turn. Because his desire is to show mercy if we will repent. And so Jonah knew this, he understood this, and so it was in his heart to have nothing to do with delivering this message of judgment, because he knew that it would give the Ninevites, whom he despised, an opportunity to turn and to repent, and that the Lord would then be inclined to show them mercy, and he didn't believe that they deserved the mercy of the Lord, and he wanted no part in that. And so he attempts to flee from the presence of the Lord. Now, I'm going to stop right here. We're at the end of our time, and we will pick up with this concept of what was actually in Jonah's mind when he tried to run from the presence of the Lord, and we will develop that through our next study in the middle section of chapter 1 next week.